We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
This is my episode. Hello and welcome to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. My name is Mark. I am on today, as per always, with Kim. How are you, Kim?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing really well, and I really think that as we do more and more of these episodes, we're starting to see the unique stories kind of gravitate to the top. It's like the cream of the crap. We see some stories have a trend, and they go one way, but then there's ones that are truly unique, and tell me if you're going through this, where you watch some of these episodes and you look at it from the surface as, all right, it's going to be this, this, and this. And when you're done, when you're at the end, it's so much bigger. It's so much scarier.
Oh, I totally agree. There was one on this episode in particular that you picked, and I know you felt the same way, that on its surface didn't seem too bad. And my God, it was one of the most depressing things I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, this one really hit a lot of different stories as well. I chose this. I don't know if you choose stories that are in particular, like you think, all right, I remember this collection of episodes and let's definitely do that. Or if you see a keyword and you're like, all right, that sounds like something interesting to discuss. But what did it for me was The Orphan Train.
Oh, yeah. I thought it might, because you and I have talked about this before.
Yeah. And it's one of these realities, but at the same time, it's one of these things where it's a strange part of our history in the United States that we had a train that would be on tour in a lot of ways. And it helped place orphan children, 200,000, I think it is, over the course of like 50 or 60 years, which is really just a generation. It's a generation of orphans that were placed throughout the country, more or less randomly. So it's a strange thing, especially in comparison to our modern times. But what we're talking about today is episode 5 of season 2 of Unsolved Mysteries.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm very excited. This might. I'm going to go by your numbers. Was released 1 week before Halloween of 1989.
Yeah, I saw in many places that date, so I felt confident putting that on there.
I wonder what I was for Halloween in 1989.
I know what I was. I was a big old, I was a pumpkin, because I was just like a blob of a pupa of a baby.
Wait, what year were you born?
89.
Oh, okay. So you were right there.
I was like 10 months old.
Adorable. I pooped my pants. Here's a lollipop. So, shakeny, what is that corn that nobody eats? Everybody hates it, but my son.
Candy corn?
Yeah, my son loves that stuff.
Me too.
Oh, okay, you're both weirdos. So we're talking about a number of different stories here. We're talking about The Platinum Pilfer. We're talking about, of course, The Orphan Train, the mysterious ghost lights, greeting card, which, some of these things, even you pointed out how what they title these things out as aren't always so accurate. And Caruana, which I just think that they could have done a better job with the names.
Yeah.
But all in all, so should we start with the Corningware Factory?
Yeah, Platinum Pilfer.
Now, right now I'm having a cup of coffee, which I made the coffee in one of these Corningware percolator things. I tried this for the first time yesterday and it came out weak. Today I tried it and it's okay. But the mug I'm using was a gift from somebody for doing 10 episodes. Woo-hoo. And Kim, I have to thank you so much for this really amazing mug, this Unsolved Mysteries Rewind mug. It's super limited edition. I believe it's limited to two. But who knows? In the future, if people have an interest, we can always enter the world of Unsolved Mysteries marketing.
I love that. There's a very handsome shirtless Robert Stack on there.
My only hope was that if I were to put cold liquid in it, that he would have a sweater on it. And then when it would put hot, it would be shirtless.
Oh, but now you know, tell me.
This is something that we might have to work on in the future.
Okay, fair enough.
That's the only way I would love this mug more. But I thank you so much for the gift. It was a tremendous surprise. And I love mugs. I'm afraid to use this because I'm afraid I'm going to break it. But I'm forcing myself to get past it and just use it.
Awesome. Well, pleasure is all mine.
But so the Corningware Glassworks plant in Bradford, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Have you ever visited a glassware factory?
No, I can't say I have.
I went to the Corning factory in Corning, New York.
Hmm.
I have a friend. He might even be listening to this. His name is Noah Gilbert. And he's a glassblower and he gives classes at Corning.
Oh, awesome.
And he's totally self-taught and he's just one of the most incredible people I've ever met in my entire life. And it's a really phenomenal, amazing place. Mm-hmm. But I did not expect that in the background of these factories, or there's actually a Corning Museum, that there may be hundreds of pounds or millions of dollars, rather, of platinum sitting right feet away from me.
Yeah, who knew? Apparently, it is the only metal that can withstand the high heat of like molten glass. Yes. And so it lines the pipes and furnaces and stuff in the Corning factory.
Now, I'm pretty sure I'm incorrect, that I was saying that it was for the platinum line of Corningware, where they have the little decorative band around it.
Yeah.
But maybe they use the scraps for that.
Yeah. Well, from my understanding, this was like a big scale glassworks for electrical conductivity, yes, something like that. It wasn't actually like the Corningware that everybody's grandma had growing up.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. Like, you think of Pyrex and these type of things. But yeah, when you have electricity in your house, like probably 99.9% of the people listening to this podcast have, there are resistors that they resist electricity, and very often they are insulated with ceramics and glass. So mm-hmm. That's it. I mean, it's pretty simple, but they're big. So have you ever heard these things explode?
Oh, no.
Oh, my God. What we get from time to time where these resistors explode. Mm-hmm. And it's always fun. And as a matter of fact, it looks a little bit like a story that we're going to talk about in a little bit called The Ghost Lights, believe it or not.
Mm.
So, and it does. It will light up the entire sky. And I even have surveillance footage from outside of my house where one is blowing up in the distance and it lights up the entire night sky. And you're like, what the hell is this?
Mm.
So I don't think it's interesting enough to share with everyone who listens to the show, but I'll share it with you.
Okay, great.
you make the judgment call. But... to get into the story, Dale Kerstetter is a 50-year-old security guard, and he's worked for the Corning Glass plant for a pretty long time. I don't know if they mentioned exactly how long he worked there, but it's been since the 50s.
Exactly. Yeah, we're in 1987 when we joined Unsolved Mysteries. He started, I believe, in 1959 as a tradesman, somebody who was making the glass. But the factory they were selling the factory to somebody else in the midst of all of this. So he got demoted to a security guard to just kind of watch over the empty factory, make sure nobody breaks in, steals any platinum, that kind of thing. And so he took a big demotion, but he was doing that. He was like 6 months away from retirement.
Now, I'm imagining this is a pretty big factory.
And yeah, they said it was 112,000 square feet.
And also, like you said, it was some type of selling of the factory to a new company. And it was happening at this very time. So do you think that this was kind of, let's take advantage of things while the changing of the guard is happening?
Yeah, I do. I think that the person in the mask, we'll get to it, but I think the person in the mask was probably a former employee who was angry that they got laid off and that they knew something was up.
Yeah, there's surveillance footage that I think anybody can look at, and they kind of think that the body language is a little bit strange, but I think you mentioned that you think it's a disgruntled employee. And that would kind of make sense because maybe Dell knew him, but right. maybe Dell wasn't aware that this person could be one of two things. One, a murderer mm-hmm. for him, or, you know, he's just a friend and he's going to get cut in.
So, yeah, so Dale's all alone. He's the security guard of this abandoned Corning factory. And all of a sudden, a man with a mask shows up. They couldn't find him the next morning. They're looking for him. Like, 4 days later, it occurs to the people who work there, like, oh, let's check the security cameras.
Like, what is that?
I know. So they check them.
Is it possible Dale is the only person who had a key to it or something?
Well, he left his keys, remember? The guy found his keys. So,
but, you know, being that it's the changing of the guards, you know, changing to a new company, I guess it's possible that maybe Dell was the only person that even had access to it or know who's had to control or use the equipment.
Yeah, him and the other security guards, because there's 24-hour security guards. The guy who realized that he was missing was the guy, John Lindquist, who came in for the 7 a.m. shift, so... He isn't seen. They check the security cameras 4 days later and they see a man in a mask and they're like, huh, that's weird. And then they see that Dale is walking with him, although he is slightly in front of him.
Right. He's leading.
He's leading. And they bring the dogs in to see if Dale maybe just like had a heart attack. This is before the cameras. See if he maybe had a heart attack. And his scent leads all the way up to the big glass furnace. And then they lose track of it. So when they check the cameras, they see this masked man is actually getting into the piping there. And that is where the platinum is held.
And he basically just cuts off a piece, right?
Yeah, he's like cutting through the, it looked like fiberglass or something. But they said that they thought he was a former employee because the lights weren't on. It was nighttime. He knew where all the tools were that he would need for this. And it makes sense. I mean, if you know the ins and outs, you know that it's going to be abandoned. And like you said, maybe Dale's in on it. It just all makes perfect sense that it's a former employee.
Now, you broke down how much it would have, the amount of platinum that they had to steal in order to get up to $250,000 worth is how many pounds?
26.
So it's not that bad. I mean, even if you have a backpack, you might not be comfortable carrying it, but you could throw it in a duffel bag or a backpack.
And here's where it gets really shady, because then the masked man is seen with a hand truck wheeling out a large body-sized bag, and we don't see Dale again.
Right, ever. Now,
ever. And if there's one thing we can say about Dale, like, honestly, his employers freaking hated him.
Oh my God, they had really nothing amazing to say about the guy.
They said he was a slow, marginal worker.
Can you imagine? I'm sorry to interrupt you. Can you imagine if somebody said, well, you know, Kim, you're more of what I would call a marginal worker?
I'd probably steal some platinum. Just no, I wouldn't. But
I would.
Like, it's so offensive. And the thing is you're walking a very fine line, because we don't know at this point if Dale is in on it and was part of this pilfer, or if he was an innocent victim. And so when you're walking that fine line, to just constantly like crap all over this guy's reputation is so tasteless.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I guess it's possible that he was really convinced that Dale was involved in it. I think on the surface, Dale was involved. It's just my personal opinion. But there's evidence on the contrary. Like, he had a pretty good relationship with his family, or seemingly did, and he just vanished. I mean, it's not unheard of that men just kind of up and leave and $250,000 in your pocket. I mean, I guess that could be tempting for somebody. And he was in debt for about $40,000, but who isn't?
Right. Yeah, and he was heading towards a pension, you know, because he was just about to retire. His daughter said, you know, I would have happily helped him out if he needed any money. But we look at the security camera, and this is all through reenactment. The camera footage has never been released to the public. So we're looking at the reenactment, and Dale looks right into the camera as if to say, like, help or goodbye or whatever. And the guys who are his managers have the gall to say, quote, that's just Dale being Dale, flaunting it, saying, I got one over on you. It's like, what? This is this cute little old security guard. I don't I don't think they're reading him right, but maybe they know something we don't. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they would definitely know him better than this description, but it just seems to be a pretty dark thing to just kind of jump to this conclusion when there's no genuine evidence to say to state that he had, in fact, done this crime.
Yeah, and I know what, probably what you're thinking out there, because I thought the same thing of like, oh, he probably got thrown into the glass furnace because, you know, that's where his scent left.
I didn't search that.
Oh, yeah, I know. I saw your browser history. My God, you're going to get in trouble. But it would have been impossible for that to happen because that's where the platinum was located, in there. So he couldn't have killed him, you know, by tossing him in there, because it would have been too hot for the bad guy to have grabbed the platinum.
No, I also read a little bit about this, and they were looking at, years and years ago, that there were people who were trying to figure, I guess, ways of cremating people quicker, which I just think, you know, that's technology, right? And they were trying to use molten glass or molten something, and they just found that it wasn't really working. It would not break down the body in a way that you would have a regular cremation happen.
Oh, okay. So there would have been some evidence left.
Yeah, that book I linked to this is very dark. It's very... it would create a thing called a glass coffin, which I believe they did with priests somewhere. Mm-hmm. I started reading, it got very, very creepy and dark, and I realized that I had to go back to New York and study about the Corning crime, not whatever's going on in like 13 something in Italy. but you know, it's there. I just believe that in a company like where you're making resistors and you're using pure glass, they would be able to find that the remains would probably spoil the glass, I guess, or make it unusable.
And everything was non-operational at the time because they were in the process of selling. But that's even more reason why they wouldn't have used that.
Yeah.
So he was actually declared legally dead in July of 2014. And I have scoured the internet high and low to bring you guys the three main theories of what happened. So theory number one is that he was just a security guard doing his thing, and he was murdered by these people that came in to take the platinum.
Mm-hmm.
His stuff was left, like it was just going to be a normal day. Most of his children think that he wouldn't have done something like this. We do have that body bag being wheeled out when the platinum was only 26 pounds, so that's really shady.
Right.
And
you could know, have been office supplies. No, I don't know. Like staplers, I mean, who knows? And Post-its.
I mean, hey, it's all possible because we don't know what happened.
Mm.
There were massive layoffs at Corning. So there's just... The only reasons I can think of that he wasn't just a pure victim is that he himself may have been disgruntled. And as we had talked about before, because his employer speaks so poorly of him, I think they probably know something we don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is it's, we don't know if he was just kind of a shady kind of guy.
Yeah. In which case, I mean, why hire him to be your security guard, you know?
I'm going to guess it was because out of... He's been there for so long. I mean, a fixture. Yeah. Where my wife works, the company, the business itself has only been there for 2 years, but the company itself has been there for like 60. Mm-hmm. And they have people who are marginal employees, and they're not going anywhere, regardless of what happens. And these are like doctors, you know?
Well, the second theory is that he was in on it and just disappeared to a new life, sipping margaritas on the beach somewhere. So the pros in that category were that he was in debt, he was recently demoted, and some people think that he was friendly with the person in the mask. And like you said, he was leading the way.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the key left in his truck, which maybe was for a quick getaway, or maybe it's just an old country man thing to do. I could see it going either way. The cons of that is that he has never been seen again, and you can't just leave with this platinum. You're going to have to turn it into money somehow, and there's only 12 furnaces in the entire United States that are capable of melting down platinum.
And that's a great point. I mean, you could steal the Hope Diamond, but where do you turn that into money?
Yeah, exactly.
It turns into all of that, but you had pointed, you know, Canada wasn't too far.
Yeah, Canada's like 2 hours away, and who knows how many platinum smelters they had in the 80s. I didn't look that stat up. But the third theory is that he was in on it all along and he was double-crossed by the masked man. So his scent was found up where the platinum was, and the bad guy had to have had some knowledge of the area because it was in the dark and he did know where the platinum was and where all the tools were. But he walked right in front of the camera. I don't think that's him flaunting, look what I did, unlike the employers. But I just think, to me, and of course we only saw the reenactment, to me it was like a help look. And I think the reason he was in front of the bad guy was because the bad guy probably had a gun to his back.
And that's, at least in the reenactment, that's kind of what they alluded to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think he was in on it. And maybe he got spooked. Maybe he didn't realize that it was... Because he was also described as a pretty simple person.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they kind of alluded to him being overly simple. And it's possible...
Yeah.
It's possible he got in over his head and got spooked. Mm-hmm. And it's like, look, take this money. Run. And it's a little heartbreaking. But for him to sacrifice saying, well, if I go home, I go to prison.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm on the run, my family isn't disgraced, you know. I'm not sure. Or maybe they killed him.
Because the platinum was never, ever found.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many question marks here. Something I did find interesting is the investigator, Bizak, he actually called Unsolved Mysteries and had them. I know, it's such a cool name.
Yeah.
He actually called Unsolved Mysteries and had them look into that. So I always think that's cool when investigators... egos get out of the way and they're able to call in extra help, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I found one of his daughters on Facebook. She's alive and well, and she was featured in this. And I don't know. I don't think, sadly, we're ever going to really know what happened to him. My personal belief is that he was just a cute little old security guard doing his little security guard thing, and he was a total victim. But that's just my theory.
Right. When they were showing the kids, I kept thinking like they were going to pull up in like, you know, a Mercedes, like a really expensive car behind them or something. It's like, I don't know where my dad is.
And it's, I see like money bags. But
right. But no, it wasn't that way.
The son kind of hints like that he thinks that he's hiding out until the statute of limitations is up.
He hopes.
Yeah. I think that's exactly what it is. I think it's hope. Like, Dale's mom and his daughters are like, no, there's no way. I think he's dead.
I mean, it's not like he could just come out after 7 years and be like, all right, you didn't catch me. I'm safe now.
Suckers.
I don't think it works like that.
I don't think so either.
Well, that brings us down to an old foamer, a train, to the orphan train. Yes. We could put a sound effect in. It's very Little House on the Prairie.
Absolutely.
I'm surprised they didn't have an episode called Orphan Train.
They do have an orphan train in one scene.
But I'm saying an episode where it's kind of Charles just goes there and goes, I'll take that one, not this one, that one.
He'd take all of them.
All right, I'll take them all. Have like 16 kids up in that loft.
Exactly.
Yeah, anyway, so as we turn the entire episode into a Walnut Grove Cast episode. So... That's always my fun, the fan fiction. But then I have to stop myself because there's a lot of creepy fan fiction out there.
Oh, yeah.
And I believe that one day we'll be talking about the true crime associated with some of that fan fiction. I hope not. So Orphan Train. Orphan Train is, and just like you wrote, is exactly what it sounds like. People who... No, not all of these orphans had deceased parents. Some just had... The parents didn't have the means to raise them.
I'm finding that a lot with episodes of Unsolved Mysteries. A lot of them are just parents that were so destitute they couldn't afford to feed another mouth.
Yeah, and you know, it's a law that even now, where you can actually give up your right as a parent and relinquish it to the state.
Mm-hmm.
Up until like 14 or something.
Oh.
And we talk about orphans and twins so often. And it gets kind of heartbreaking, and this is very heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But it's also very sweet for one of them.
Yeah, we have sweet and we have sour. So the first one is usually what would happen is that they had so many orphans in New York that they would put all the kids in their Sunday best, put them on a train, and load them out to go to the South and to the Midwest. And then that way lots of like rural communities that needed help on the farms would be able to like pick their kids out. And it seems real flim flam. Like it seems like you could just be like, oh, I want that one, two of those, you know.
It's, can I just interrupt you? I just want to ask the people who are listening, if you know of a good book that discusses the history of orphan trains, maybe the crimes that might have been associated, because it definitely seems like a perfect opportunity for, I guess, for abuse, really.
Oh, yeah, and, absolutely.
It's kind of like the World's Fair in Chicago, the way, you know, people would take advantage of these young women who would go there to explore the city, and they would be kidnapped, and you know, all of these horrible, heinous crimes were committed. So I just wanted to say, if you do happen to have a book or, I don't know, anything, you know, please send it our way.
Yeah, find us the Unsolved Mysteries Rewind podcast Facebook page. We post all the episode resources on there, and you can get in touch with us.
And we are releasing a new website that we'll be dedicated to using. I think we'll release it next time just because it's not started up yet.
Well, one of the stories on the orphan train is actually an update from a previous episode of Unsolved Mysteries where there's an orphan named Sylvia Wemhoff. In 1921, she was 3 years old, put on an orphan train, and adopted by John and Marie Mick in Columbus, Ohio. So when she was in her late teens, you know, she kind of wondered, maybe I have brothers and sisters out there, maybe I could find my biological family. And she searched for over 50 years before she put her birth certificate out to the Unsolved Mysteries crew. And the day after the broadcast, she was told that her 72-year-old brother, Joseph, was living in New York City. So on September 25th, she flew to New York, and she's so cute. She's like, come meet your sister. Give her a hug. And they're so old.
Oh, my God. They're amazing. And I am so, like, I was, like, totally emotional watching this.
It was very cute. Exchanging pictures. Like, look at how I used to look growing up. Oh, you look like our aunt. You know, it was very cute.
I just wish I liked my brothers or sisters this much.
Yeah, it was sweet. Maybe you have to be apart for, you know, 70 years to like them so much.
But, well, I'm trying that. I'm on the path.
Okay, good. Well, of course, because they were older when this was filmed, Joseph died in 1996 and Sylvia has died in 2008. But it sounds like they got some really good closure and a few good years in there. So that was a nice story.
They're really, really cute together. And I picture them kind of getting an apartment and just living together and complaining about something. The steak is too chewy or something.
God, I love that.
It's a sitcom all of a sudden.
Seriously.
Screenplay. Another screenplay. All right. Too many. But they were such a positive story in this entire aspect. But in Unsolved Mysteries fashion, you're happy, but it's not going to last too long.
They got to pull you right back down.
Frances Murphy. Now, Frances Murphy was 11 years old in 1928. This really, my wife and I were watching this, and my wife cries at every single one of these things, and I just look away and tear up.
Aw, yeah, this one especially. Like, I have been on a very solid antidepressant for a good chunk of my life, so I don't cry externally. Yeah. No tears come out, but I was crying on the inside. Oh, my God, I wrote in the notes, like, why are you doing this to me, Mark? This is the saddest.
You wrote that, yeah. Now my son is 11, so I'm of course putting myself in a situation, you know, I'm like, you know, I don't blame the parents because who knows what their circumstances were, but I'm putting myself in the sensitive, fragile nature of an 11-year-old and, you know, he's riding that orphan train and he left behind his mother and his little baby sister and he's going out west. Right.
And he's so excited about it. Like most of the time you hear about, like, I was ripped from their arms. And he even said, like, I wasn't really that close to my mom anyway. Like, I didn't feel like I was being torn away. I was a little New Yorker heading out west. And what I had seen was, like, from the movies. So I thought I was going to be a cowboy and see some Indians. Like, he was excited. Yes. He said it was the biggest adventure of his lifetime.
But he never got adopted.
Oh, my God. They said stop after stop, people were getting adopted left and right. Bam, bam, bam. Until he was the only one left on the train.
He met Charles Ingalls and he's like, not this one.
I'm good. Yeah. Oh my God. It was so sad. And then Unsolved Mysteries just shows us the sad little orphan boy going back on the train all the way back, taking this lonely ride all the way back to New York.
But I don't know. Have you read the Harry Potter books?
I mean, when I was a kid.
Yes. There's one particular little line in, I think, the first one where the mean aunt and uncle are buying all of the kids ice cream. Mm-hmm. And they, and then they realize they're not buying it for Harry. So they kind of get embarrassed. So they buy him the cheapest thing that they have. And Harry just looks at it and goes, it was a lemon icy, but I thought it was delicious. Like, the kid is constantly positive. And that's kind of what I thought about.
Yes.
He was on the train all alone, but I think that he's the type of person where he's like, but I'm on the train all alone. Woo! It's a party. You know, he probably got all the dinner for himself.
Oh my God, I know.
I hope.
And it's like, could one of the ladies who worked there not have taken him in or something? Oh my God, to be the last one on this whole train. And maybe there was other stops that he went to where it was just him standing out there and nobody wanted him. And why wouldn't you want an 11-year-old boy to work on your farm? And
whoa,
he looks so cute.
Back it up.
No, okay, sorry.
No, but you're right. You know, he wasn't like this frail, puny kid or anything.
Yeah, he looked like a happy, sweet little boy. He was so cute. He was never adopted. He bounced around foster care to foster care. And then the last nail in the coffin is that right after they filmed the story, he died.
Like weeks later.
Yeah, like it hadn't even aired yet, but the family still asked Unsolved Mysteries to air his story because his wife said it was like the most important thing in the world to him. Here's what his wife said.
By the way, I like his wife a lot. I think she seems super sweet.
She's adorable. Yeah. And the fact that she wants to carry on this journey for him, even though he's dead, like, is so beautiful. But she said he didn't really know much about love growing up. Yeah. It's so sad. And we end with no update or no nothing. And then Unsolved Mysteries shows us that sad little orphan on the train again. Oh my God. So in 2020, there's still no updates. We know that the mother's name was Hilda Hearing Murphy and that his father's name was Martin Murphy. But his sister, Margaret, was either born in 1926 or 1927, which means if she's alive, she's like 93 nowadays.
All I'm saying is that Unsolved Mysteries Rewind is adopting Francis Murphy. He's ours now.
He's our boy. Oh my God. Congratulations.
No, but
pass up the cigars.
Yeah. Yeah. He just has to, hopefully he's strong enough to dig holes. But all in all, this is a very sad story, but it looks as though what he did, and he also, when he got married, he had created an entire family. So he created precisely what he wanted.
I love that we're adopting him, though. I think that's fair. I think that's beautiful because he seemed like a great guy. Sadly, Christine passed away in 2006, but they're reunited again.
Yeah. But it definitely gets you all emotional. But it's Unsolved Mysteries. It's like they're singing a sad song and it goes, there's ups and downs. It's like a DJ. Got to get you out on the dance floor. So
back up we go.
So where do we go? We go to Tejas, to Texas.
Mm-hmm. Marfa.
In the 1800s, I think this is a fun story that took up too much time, personally.
Oh.
I love the story, but I think it's just natural phenomenon. But these are the unexplained ghost lights of Marfa, Texas.
Yeah, and if you guys are interested, there's a free Google book called History and Mystery of the Lone Star State that does a pretty deep dive on this, but it is interesting.
I think that it's really interesting, and there's no resolution as to what it is, which, of course, puts it in the world of Unsolved.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of why I love it.
No, I couldn't agree more. I've never experienced anything like this. I think if I were to experience it and physically see it, I might feel very different. It's just that when I was reading about it, it seemed as though it might fall into that category of being either St. Elmo's fire or some type of manifestation of static electricity. But why over and over again in this one location? That's the part that really doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, so I guess you and I are going to have to take a road trip out to Marfa, Texas to experience this firsthand. But it starts in the 1800s, a cowboy named Robert Ellison noticed these strange, like, glowing orbs that were all sizes and colors off in the distance. He originally thought it was, like, Indian campfire, but they would, like, shoot up into the sky and, you know, do loop-de-loos. Like, they don't conform to any, they don't stay in one place. In 1916, 18-year-old Hallie Stillwell noticed the same thing, and she says that she coined the term ghost lights. In 1943, an Army Air Force base in Marfa, they see the lights again, and they said that there were no lights at the time. Like, there was nothing out there. It was pitch black, and everybody saw the lights. They don't know if it's ball lightning, St. Elmo's fire, or jackrabbits with glowworms attached to their tails, says Robert Stack.
But Unsolved Mysteries always has somebody on speed dial. So they called up three scientists. A chemistry professor, a geologist, and an astronomer walk into a bar. Oh, wait, no. This isn't.
into an episode of Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah. And they conduct a formal investigation as to what is going on. And it's in the desert, right? Is it the desert?
I think so. I mean, it's basically like on the lower panhandle on the west side of Texas.
You know, I'm just going to do a quick search because I don't know Texas very well. I think of it as really Mexico. And so I'm wondering if there's any people that we know virtually that may even live nearby. So I'm just always curious about that. But I'm going to bring that up and hit that up in a minute. But so, yeah, they do a real investigation as to what's going on. And I'm thinking, all right, well, this is where the whole thing falls apart. This is where you ask the guy to bend the spoon in front of you. This is where the mentalist can all of a sudden not read your mind or something. But the light appears on film.
Yeah, sure does. We have two different versions of it. The same light, but on different film. Unsolved Mysteries had everybody out there with their night vision goggles and these chemists all lined up. And, you know, sure enough, we see lights, you know, up in the air and flickering, and then they'd go away and they'd come back. They're green, they're red. Like, oh, it was cool.
You know, it really was. And when I did watch it, I just thought, this would probably scare me if there was no electricity. You know, if you are on a horse and this is 150 years ago. Mm-hmm. And you're in the middle of nowhere, really. It's probably in the middle of nowhere today. Imagine back then, it's really in the middle of nowhere. And I'm looking at it and it's just, the place is like south of Albuquerque. I'm going to guess this is really the desert. Or is it?
Oh, yeah, no, I think that's fair.
Compared to Long Island, I think it's the desert. So, we don't have any places like this. But yeah, I mean, if I saw this, and you do have the legend that kind of goes on for a very long time. You know, there's a history to it. It's a legend, there's a history, and now there's an actual manifestation as to the phenomenon. So what is it? And they don't know what it is.
Yeah, nope. We have no idea what it is. And there's like about 15 different things that it could be. I don't even know if it's worth listing them all off. But everywhere that I saw it was, is it ghosts? Is it Will-o'-the-Wisp? Is it combustible dust? St. Elmo's fire, ball lightning, to name a few. I like what Julie Plumley, the daughter of Cowboy Robert Ellison, said when she was like, let's not even figure it out. Let's just leave it as it is and enjoy them.
You know, I like that idea. But it's usually the cop-out comment.
Oh, definitely.
Let's not investigate it. You know, let's not find out how it's made because then we'll ruin it. You know,
A fun little superstition that I found from the aforementioned book that I said, The Histories and Mysteries of the Lone Star State, was that Native Americans' Great Spirit created the stars, took all of the leftover dust and rock from creating the stars and tossed them down in Marfa, Texas, and they became these big giant mountains. And the devil got so jealous that he filled it with everything that stings, bites, or pricks. So anyone who died by any of the devil's creations in that mountain range where their spirits were released as these lights over Marfa.
I truly love those type of that type of folklore. And it really is I think stuff like that is so meaningful when it comes especially to the region and the way people would tell stories and explain things. And I know there's a sweetness to it, and I'm glad you found that. I found that nowhere, and I was really I love folklore. So
me too.
Folklore, I almost will enjoy folklore more than I'll enjoy some fact-based writing on something. It's just,
yeah,
it's just,
I would rather have that. Exactly. Sorry. I would rather have that than a scientific explanation for what it is. I don't know. It was fun. It was a good, fun story.
It is. It's just weird. Like, this is a very, this episode is very all over, because you get to this yep. point, you're thinking, all right, well, they're probably going to throw in some lame ass story now.
Oof. No, but no, no, no.
We have a Canadian story.
Yeah. Canadian American. We have Canadians in America.
Right. And it does not involve platinum, but it might. No, it doesn't.
Ooh.
It's around the same period of time, because it is only another month after. So, mm-hmm. Or 2 months after. So that would have been amazing. Like, to somehow tie these together, but that's, you know, truly fiction.
Yeah.
But we have Jay Cook and Tanya. I'm not going to say her name.
Okay. Tanya Van Culemborg.
Oof. as somebody who does not have an easy name to pronounce, I don't even try to pronounce people who have yeah. the word Van in their last name.
Okay.
So, oh, sorry, I just hit my microphone stand. So, they're a boyfriend and girlfriend. Tanya's a little mm-hmm. bit younger. She's 17. He's 20. And mm-hmm. but they seem as though, from the consensus of the families, they seem to make a pretty good couple.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
Even though Jay is a little bit older, they seem to be pretty trusting of him. It seems like he's a good kid.
Yeah, so much so that the dad, Jay's dad, actually sends him and Tanya together to take one of those car ferries from Canada to Washington mm-hmm. and to get some parts for his dad's business.
Have you ever gone on one of these things?
Oh, yeah. I've actually gone on this very one from Victoria, Canada to Washington.
Really? That must have... is that a long trip?
You know, I was like 8 at the time. Oh, okay. I really don't remember. But I want to say maybe like 3 hours or something like that. Not too bad.
We have one that's from Long Island to Connecticut. Like, you have to drive out east. And it's a fun experience. You know, you park the car on there and get off. And...
yeah, it is pretty fun.
Yeah. I'm sorry, go on.
Oh, no. So they were just going to go take the van over to where they were going to get the supplies, sleep in it overnight. There was a mattress in the back of the van. And then get the parts and come back home. So after disembarking, they were seen twice. It was believed that they were going to take another car ferry from Bremerton, Washington to Seattle, Washington to get the parts. So they were expected home the next day, but they never showed up. Sadly, we do find Tanya's body out in the woods, partially clothed. She had been raped and murdered and shot in the head with a .38.
Yeah, and they found the zip ties. I don't know why it is, but zip ties just scared the hell out of me when they're used in these situations.
They're so sinister. There's no escaping them.
And I always have zip ties for all of my wires and electronics. So mm-hmm. it's just one of those things. You see something that's genuinely an innocent item, and it's used for such horrible reasons. They sadly raped and murdered this poor girl.
Yeah, and because we haven't found Jay yet, Jay's mom tells us that he was actually thought of as the suspect for a long time. She seems almost
embarrassed about it.
Yeah, wouldn't you? Oh my gosh.
I mean, you're dealing with your daughter's death to begin with, and her rape and murder, and on top of it, it might be her boyfriend? This yeah. sweet guy, you know.
It's... well, yeah, exactly. And he does look like a sweetheart.
Yeah.
So
they both do. They both will just look like your typical 80s yeah. kids.
Wholesome, yeah. wholesome. Canadian, wholesome. So the next day, the van is found about 90 miles away in Bellingham, Washington. So they do think that they were able to catch that second ferry. And unfortunately, they found more zip ties, and the mattress in the back of the van was covered in blood. So 2 blocks away near Greyhound Station, police found under like the porch of a bar, they found zip ties, keys to the van, Tanya's driver's license, plastic surgical gloves, and a half-empty box of .38 ammunition.
What? I'm just kind of curious. Sorry. Now, I know why you don't take along with you like Tanya's driver's license, right? Or mm-hmm. or any of the evidence to associate it with it. But do you destroy it, or do you, I just don't know. Do you leave it there? I mean, it's somebody possibly wanting to leave evidence of some sort. It's yeah, a very well, strange I mean, thing.
Something that we do have to keep in mind, which we haven't mentioned yet, is that her backpack was stolen. So I'm sure he probably went through and got rid of all the identifying things and just kind of tossed them, you know.
That's true.
I don't understand people that want to toss all their evidence together in one place. It seems like a great way to find every single thing linking to them.
And I've said before, I don't understand why people don't destroy things. I don't want to give people any ideas either.
Of course.
But I also tend to forget that a lot of times the people who are doing the killing are idiots.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not exactly in their right state of mind. So it's very possible that he doesn't know any better. He's just a complete... Yeah. Sometimes I tend to put the murderer on, I hate to say it, but a pedestal, where I think, you got away with it. You know, you have to have some level of intelligence when it was really probably just dumb luck.
I completely understand. Yeah, and we're kind of in a society where we have movies with, like, the Kaiser Soze's and this kind of stuff, where it's like, ooh, he's so much smarter than these detectives. But like you said, they're usually just idiots, and this is in a pre-DNA era where you could just toss it out and hope for the best.
Well,
so
you bring in DNA, because that comes into the story in a little bit.
Yes, it does. But first, sadly, Thanksgiving Day. A pheasant hunter is out with his hunting dog, and his hunting dog discovers the body of Jay, 20-year-old Jay. They don't tell us this, and this is a pretty grisly fact, but tissue and a pack of Camel Light cigarettes were shoved down his throat, and he had been strangled to death with twine tied onto dog's collars.
Now, what I'm thinking is, are you using the collars as handles?
Okay, I don't know. I don't know. I didn't know if the... I don't know. It's so grim, but I didn't know if he put the dog collar around his neck and hung him over something with the twine. I had no idea what to make of that. It seems like the Camel Lights are going to do the trick, you know? Like a whole pack?
Yeah.
I don't know. It was overkill. He was bashed with a rock. Like, it was just horrible. And this guy... I don't know. This shouldn't matter, but he probably weighed 100 pounds soaking wet. Like, it's such overkill.
Yeah, they just beat the living crap out of it. They just tortured this guy for seemingly just for fun.
Yeah.
And
that's exactly what I think it is. And for some reason, and they still won't tell us why, they think that the person who did this had been in prison before because of what Jay had on his body.
Which I don't get. I mean, is it possible they carved something in, or...
Possible. I thought maybe it was the cigarettes thing, because that seems kind of jail-y.
Mm-hmm. It could be. And maybe they're like, well, we don't want you to say it so much, you know, beat around the bush and say it in a different way.
Yeah. Oh, it's just so sad. These poor kids at the prime of their life going on their first little, like, overnight trip together. So the police think that they did take that second ferry to Seattle and that they met their killer there, who probably asked for a ride. And because they're sweet little innocent Canadians who are young, they offered it to him, and that he murdered them from there. They said that he probably just wanted, like, he was probably after Tanya to rape her, and that he had to kill Jay because Jay was in the way. So we never recovered Jay's jacket, Tanya's backpack, or her camera. Now, this is where it gets extra messed up, okay?
This is just, you think it's over at this point, right? Like, all right, let's get to the next story, Unsolved Mysteries, but no.
No, you're going to the next level of hell if you're this guy. So 4 weeks after they're killed, the parents of the victims receive greeting cards that are just taunting them about the death of their children. Like, I am on a victory tour for murdering your kid. Like, oh, it was so joyous to me. Oh my God, it was horrible. They actually received 19 greeting cards over 3 different holidays taunting them, and they had been postmarked from New York, LA, and Seattle.
Now, we do find out in the that it was not actually the killer who sent these, which I think makes it kind of worse.
I kind of think it's a little bit better, because
we
find out in 2010 that a 78-year-old Canadian transient with serious mental health issues had been sending those cards. They think that he saw the story in a newspaper and kind of attached himself to it in his mind. And if you know somebody sick like that, I don't know, you have to cut him a little more credit, versus if it's the actual guy reliving how he killed your kid and you know he's just, like, getting off on it in some sick way. Like, oh, that to me is worse.
I just feel like, you know, him getting off on it is probably the reality of the situation, if he's even thinking about it, you know. To randomly choose a story from the news and then target somebody, I don't know. It's all a matter of opinion, you know, one perspective from to another. It's just, it's both completely demented, both situations.
Like, to re-victimize somebody who's already been horrifically victimized, like I said, there's a special place in hell. Like, it's so cruel.
Like, what's your end game with something like that?
Exactly. And I understand that people murder each other all the time. Like, I get that that is a reality that we live in. But to just torture these people that are already suffering, like you said, what's your end game? There's no point. Yeah. So we do get an update. William Earl Talbot Jr. was arrested after a DNA match, and that's all they need us on.
Goodbye. See you later.
We're not going to do that to you.
In all seriousness, all right, Kim, you're the producer of Unsolved Mysteries, hypothetically. All right. Mm-hmm. Do you say, look, this is a good story. Let's put it on the shelf until next year, because there's going to be something that comes out, even in 2 years. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or do you just release the information and then do some type of future update?
I don't know. I'd probably check the gate. I'd be like, get it out. Let's go, people. This is about quantity, not quality.
Shut up, Stack. Just read the cue cards. All right. You think they bullied him? Oh, man. I hopefully they didn't.
I doubt it.
No, I know. I'm joking. He was the star. Come on.
Yeah. He's a talent. So a little deep diving led me to some information that he, William Earl Talbot, was actually the first person convicted of genealogical evidence. And you got to think about it, like how they got the Golden State Killer, how they tested somebody in his family tree who did one of those DNA tests, like 23andMe.
Yeah.
And they found it. So what happened was they collected semen from Tanya's trousers in 1987. This is pre-DNA. And then they enter it into a genealogical database, and they found that his second cousin was taking a test, just, you know, like people do. And they were able to link from there, okay, he's related to this person distantly. He has the markers for being overweight, bald. Like, they had all this stuff based just off of the DNA structure.
Mm-hmm.
So they find this guy who's a 55-year-old truck driver, and they just decide to follow him. At the time of the crime, he's 24. This is all in like 2018, 2019. But they follow him. He's drinking a water or soda, whatever, and he throws his cup out the window onto the road. So the police swoop in, grab it, and they're actually able to match the DNA of the saliva on that to the semen on her trousers in 1987. So he was arrested and convicted of 2 life sentences.
Well, I mean, that's great. It's just, wow. Like, do you think that goes to the FBI? Do you think, it's such a big story. It really is. I mean, first they did the semen was collected from Tanya's trousers. And which is always just weird to me. It's like, hey, you know, call the semen guy, you know.
I know.
But so they have this in a database, and then they get some level of a cross reference. Have you ever done the 23andMe?
No, never.
Yeah, I don't think I will.
I'm good.
Yeah.
I don't either.
I don't want anything getting linked to
me. Just in case my uncle murdered like 21 people.
Right. I don't need to talk to anybody about their problems.
Right.
But yeah, I just think it's such a big story. I think I hate to say it's a wonderful end, because it's something that should have just been avoided to begin with. We should never have even learned of these people's names. But now that we do have it, just amazing that over such a short period of time in reality, 30 some odd years, this person is finally caught. And hopefully he's regretting every moment of it.
And thank goodness that their parents were able to get closure for this, know that that their kids' lives did matter to people, you know, that I'm just impressed that the police never gave up. They kept looking in like 2018 to find the killer, and good work all around. And I do think it is just a Washington State thing, because I know he's now in the Washington State Penitentiary.
See, I mean, this type of research, not to put that in Canada, this type of research is not going to happen outside of the United States. I just don't believe it. I don't believe that that the Canadians are going to have the reach that our overreach to do these type of things. It's a matter of opinion. That's me being very, I guess, prejudiced towards Canadians. But maybe you should have treated me a little nicer when I visited last summer. we did. We had an absolutely terrible time in Niagara. But it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. It's over. But I think that it's incredible. I think the 23andMe thing is always very tempting. But I'm never going to do it.
No, me neither. It's so creepy to just put your DNA in a database. And I don't plan on murdering anybody. That's not the thing. But I don't like just having my DNA on file.
Oh,
but
my God. By the way, Jack just texted me. He's like, I heard. Thank God.
You know what?
Wow.
But it doesn't even really matter, honestly, because I'm sure like our second cousins five times removed on our aunt's side have already taken it. And so we're already busted if anything happens.
Yeah.
Very big brothery, but we won't get too
political. Yeah. But you got to watch your own back. Now the person
don't murder people.
The person that was busted was a 78-year-old, as you mentioned, transient Canadian.
Yeah, this is the guy for writing the letters.
He's a Canadian, just saying it, just putting it out there, it's a fact. And of course I'm joking about Canada if anybody's listening from Canada. It's a lovely country. So I just think the guy's a douche. Like, the guy's kind of a jerk. Even if you have mental issues and all of this kind of stuff, there has to be some level of, maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, but there has to be that choice to want to terrorize somebody. And I just think it's so unfair.
Yeah, it's horrific. It's the absolute last things that these families who are already grieving needed. But I mean, it is the way of the world, sadly.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully, he never is released. You know, hopefully, you know, he really lives a very long time.
I'm sure he's probably dead now. The 78-year-old?
Really? Oh, no. I'm talking about the other guy. The guy who got the 2 years.
No. He's going to stay there forever. He's got 2 life sentences without parole.
I don't believe that the 78-year-old probably spent a day in jail. He was probably just kind of like...
Oh, I'm sure not.
Probably didn't do anything to him.
I mean, it's a jerk move, but I don't think it's illegal.
You know, I mean, probably on some level, it's like targeted harassment or something. Maybe it's like a misdemeanor type of thing where you pay $500. But I don't think he's going to spend an overnight in a jail for that. You won't need bail money. So now we get to
Connecticut.
Yeah, Groton, Connecticut, in a very strange type of thing. Because we're talking about underground, organized crime going in the Northeast. Now, I wrote a note here saying that they brought up the New England mob, right?
Yeah. What is that?
Yeah. It's like, let's go and, you know, instead of having like an Italian meal, you're having lobster. I don't know. But of course, I'm just joking around. But I guess organized crime is anywhere where there's somebody that is willing to pay protection money. Or something like that. Or smoke large amounts of marijuana.
Right. So we are looking for Salvatore Caruana. He is like a big time drug smuggler. You and I kind of talked about how he was in charge of smuggling $40 million worth of marijuana in the 80s.
Yeah. I mean, this is, we're not talking about, you know, a duffel bag. We're talking about like a tractor trailer, right? I mean, I don't know.
It has to be.
It has to be. Pallets.
Yeah.
Pallets of money, pallets of everything. I'm in the wrong line of business.
Seriously. Well, I don't know. No. Because in 1983, this guy was arrested, charged with drug trafficking under the Kingpin statute. So he was actually looking at life in prison. Mm. But whoever the judge was decided to let this drug kingpin bond out for $50,000. And then, of course, he was never seen from again.
Yeah, I mean, that just seems like corruption as well. Like, maybe, you know, I don't want to point my fingers or anything like that, but it was a poor choice.
You're making $40 million on one drug transaction and his house was like a fortress. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that $50,000 is just pocket change to this guy.
Right,
this guy said it was like hours.
He has it in his back pocket. He's just like, that's it?
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, not that it matters, but this reenactor gets my MVP award. I loved this guy. He was amazing. He was very, like, Hasselhoffian.
I liked the whole segment. And again, we thought that the episode would be over.
Yeah, no, this one had a lot jam-packed in. So we kind of dabble with the DEA assembling a task force to get him. So they raid his home in Peabody, Massachusetts, and they find guns and like briefcases full of cash and more guns
Now,
and
is this the
fake
house with the
IDs.
big camera on top?
Yeah, so they make it sound like it's a super fortress because it has a camera on
But
top.
wait, did you
But
notice
I
this
read more
camera?
about it, and
It
it
must be
actually is
4 feet
pretty cool.
long.
Well, this thing was huge. It was like surveilling the whole place. And keep in
I've
mind, this
never
is like
seen a camera like
1980s.
this. I thought it was a laser or something. Like it, why would it? I just think it's crazy. And did it swivel? Like I just wish I knew more about this camera that was on top of this house.
I'm gonna say it swiveled.
And it,
I
you know
think we
what?
can confidently say it swiveled.
I bet you they had a little motor where they go, wing,
yeah.
Wing, you know, so like a pan, tilt, zoom type of situation.
This guy's like a Bond villain. His whole house was a labyrinth of like fake mazes that were like, if you went in the wrong place, it would throw like poison gas and C4 out at you if you did the wrong thing.
It's
It had
crazy.
like fake bookcases that you pushed and went to different rooms. It was very cool. Like, this whole story was kind of cool,
But
if I'm
the
being
house looks
honest.
like your typical suburban split level with a
But
big camera
beautiful.
on top.
I'd live there.
No, it was a nice house. You know, and they showed on different angles and they were like, oh, that is maybe the back and it looks a lot nicer. But when they showed the house where it's just the one with the camera on top, it's basically your typical, like, I guess, you know, Long Island house, really.
Yeah, it
And
looked pretty modest.
yeah, like you don't, if you were driving down the street and you saw that house, you wouldn't really think it's, you know, a kingpin's house, maybe.
Yeah, but that's probably the idea.
Yes, I couldn't agree more, except for this big camera
Right.
that's tilting back and forth constantly, then I would just be selling my house probably. It's too creepy. So we,
They're able to track him down to like a motor inn. Motel kind of thing, and he was using the alias Vincent Spirito, and the DEA are like, let's go, we're gonna raid it. And so they go and they're, you know, clear, clear, and they open it up, and there's like all these old newspapers and old rotted food and like a juicy 1980s computer,
Yeah.
and it looks like he hasn't been there for a while, but they realize that he has been like covertly messaging his wife to get messages across.
Well, what he was doing, and I'm gonna just mention this is at a period of time before the internet was legitimately in existence. And what you used is a BBS system, which they kind of allude to. They talk about it just a little bit, but it's a BBS. And what you would do is through a phone line, you would connect to the BBS and you can transfer data to or you can download data to the computer. I have this identical model computer. It's bought at Radio Shack. It's a Tandy TRS-80 and has like the two drives and everything. And it's not something you would consider to be a portable computer, which is what makes the whole thing kind of strange. It's also not a very powerful computer even for the time. But he would use it to just kind of access this stuff, and he would probably really be using the technology to just transfer messages because nobody was really watching the VBSs back then. Even the FBI was really new to the fact that people could communicate through computers.
And they said even so, he was still like using code that his wife knew, that he could make messages to her and she would have to like decode them.
Yeah, I mean, it was very. I mean, the guy seemed to have a bit of a level of intelligence when he's like throwing his business around. He's not just kind of doing dealings right out in the open.
No, he is very cool. Like they said, he is a licensed air pilot. He is a computer expert. Like he's an interesting guy. So when they raid his place, they think he hasn't been there in a while because they did find like the spoiled fruit and the old newspapers. And they found this ready to rock and roll sawed-off shotgun that was like fully loaded.
Yeah.
So they think he was
What did they
expecting
call
a
it?
fight.
What did they
Oh,
call it?
combat ready?
Yeah, I like that. I like the way that he said that.
Like, I'm a little embarrassed about how cool I think this whole thing is, but it is like I would watch the movie based on this guy's life. So, what's missing is his van keys, his wallet, and the camera case that had an Uzi in it that he was never without.
An
So,
Uzi. I mean, this is, it's like the A team all of a sudden. It's,
yeah.
this is a serious guy. This is the type of guy who easily, if you were to get in trouble with, he would probably kill you.
Oh yeah, they say he is considered armed and extremely dangerous. 1 month later, his van is completely wiped down and abandoned at a Connecticut truck stop, and that's where we leave Unsolved Mysteries. Mm. So, something interesting is that this is all allegedly, this is what I found from the internet, so please don't come murder me. But in October of 1990, the remains of three men were found buried underneath a garage in Hamden, Connecticut. One sets of these remains was positively identified as Massachusetts hotel executive Theodore Burns, while the other two were never identified. It is suspected that Caruana is one of the other victims. Before his death, mob underboss William the Wild Guy Grasso allegedly told mob associate Jack Johns that he had Caruana killed because he suspected that Caruana was about to be captured by the authorities and that he would become an informant. So according to Grasso, William the Wild Guy Grasso, Caruana's body was buried under the garage, but they've never tested it, so he is still listed as a wanted fugitive.
It's incredible. I mean, it's so incredible that this information, it comes out and you pull it all together in such an amazing way. I really have to credit you with doing so much of these amazing deep dives, Kim. Like, seriously.
Well, thank you.
I love it.
It's the pleasure's all mine. There's so many times I'm left wanting more from Unsolved Mysteries, and it's awesome what you're able to find. Of course, it's all off the internet, so take it with a grain of salt. But I think that it's some good food for thought. I hope we do the deep dive so you guys don't have to.
Well, exactly. And to your credit, when we got to the end of the story about Jay Cook and Tanya, mm-hmm. you know, it really did leave you kind of wanting to know what the next step is. My wife just literally said, just like you said, and I said, probably, that's it, you know?
Yeah.
And I said, but that's what Unsolved Mysteries Rewind is about. It's about taking the story further. It's about, and I said, don't worry, because Kim's going to find out exactly what happened to this person. I said it just like that. And,
awesome.
And she goes like this, well, I hope so. Well, well, she doesn't work for you. So. But we do work for our listeners. So.
Yes, we do. And if you have suggestions, or if you just want to talk about these crazy episodes or see gifts that we goof on mm-hmm. from this show, please follow us on Facebook, Unsolved Mysteries Rewind Podcast on Facebook.
Yeah, and we have a lot of fun stuff still in the works. Everything. I mean, this episode, I believe, is our 12th episode.
Yay!
It's our dozen. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, it really kind of went quickly, I think.
Yeah.
We just launched the podcast a month from right now. Of course, by the time this gets released, it'll be a couple months. But mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm really always looking forward to the next one. And I'm really looking forward as to where this podcast will take us. You did one last thing I do want to just mention. I'm not going to mention the person's name, but
oh my God.
I'll use her first name, Cindy. Posted about this story about who's the main guy, Salvatore.
Caruana.
Yeah. And I think these type of things are very strange. That people,
yeah.
No, it could be true. It could not be true, but she claims to have dated him back in the early 80s and that he was deciding to escape of some sort. He's going to go on his yacht. And she mm-hmm. said, well, I have these two annoying dogs. Can I come? And he said, no. So she's like, well, I'm going to stay with my dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And he left her. It sounds like a little bit of fiction.
Oh, yeah.
Or it could have been more along the lines of maybe she did date him. And he was just like, well, you can't bring your two dogs. All right, yeah. I won't bring them. Well, you can't bring any luggage either. You know, he was just making excuses.
Yeah. Or maybe he dumped her and she was like, oh, well, he was the bad guy and I'm the good guy because I stuck up for my dogs.
There's a lot of girls like this in Brooklyn who date a lot of guys who are in the news. And they legitimately dated these guys who might have ended up in the news. I will not mention any names, but they have stories that are kind of like this. But, you know, sometimes they're fiction, sometimes they're not. I tend to be in the middle. But it's just weird to go online and post this thing with your last name attached. But we will not be linking it. It's easily yeah. found anyway. But just it's kind of strange. Hopefully it's not her real last name.
Yeah, I hope not too.
But Cindy, if you're out there, we appreciate your courage. Watch your back. So thank you very much for listening. We always appreciate it. Right now we are at one website. We're going to be making a few quick changes. And so just, I guess, stay tuned. I guess episode 13 is when it's going to be the big unveil of a new domain name and all that kind of good stuff.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.